You're listening to Donuts and Top Cow.
Two great tastes that taste better together.
Thanks for listening. This is John Grigas.
And I'm Josh Crawley. And there's some other people around.
There's
and,
at least three other people in this room.
Yeah, they're going to talk soon.
I'm Jason Punzwick.
I'm Jimmy Hayes.
And we're recording at Westfield Comics on the east side of Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, we'd like to thank Westfield Comics, our major sponsor. You can shop with Westfield Comics online at www.westfieldcomics.com for to-your-door service. You can get your pull list. You can get your subscription service at a discount. Just go online. If you're in the Madison area, please stop by one of the two retail locations. As Josh just said, currently on the east side location on Williamson Street. And we're joined by some friends, as you know. We have Jason and Jimmy have come. Jimmy's come up from Chicago. Jason's come over from Madison. Actually, he's here, so that's good. We've been trying to get both of these guys on the show for a while, so thanks for coming in. And today we're going to talk about Witchblade 146.
Oh, yeah. It's hot.
It is hot. I was saying to Jimmy earlier that, you know, Ron and in particular Stefan Sejic have come a really long way in building the Witchblade brand out of the reputation for being like a TNA book as far as the street reputation. Issue 146 isn't necessarily the one that you would give to your wife to say, no, look, honey, this is not a TNA book.
No, it really wouldn't be.
But it also is not gratuitous, and it is not unimportant to the story. It fits in with the times that are being depicted, and we'll take a walk through it. I know that Jimmy and Jason they do read some Top Cow books, but I don't know if they would say that they were big Top Cow, you know, it was a big part of their reading list, but I'm real interested in what they have to think about this issue. How did you like it, Jimmy? I know that you read it on the way up from Chicago.
I actually haven't read Witchblade since Michael Turner was drawing it, so this was a really big, I guess, comeback issue for me. And I ended up really liking it. The recap page was nice, so I knew what was going on.
Yeah, that's a big thing. I really like the recap pages that Top Cow does in the beginning of their books.
No, it was great, and I will honestly buy the next issue because I'm interested to see what happened.
Sweet. Well, the issue opens up definitely in ancient times. It looks old Egypt. We're talking many years B.C., maybe as many as 80 B.C., and there is a pharaoh, and at his side, you know, we're not really sure who the characters are, but it develops through the story. But a pharaoh is being brought a prisoner, and this prisoner is somebody who had been fighting in the fields, and it is someone who is scantily clad yet mystical. Josh is pumping his fist there, which is good. And his field general brings in this chained prisoner, and the prisoner obviously has some supernatural powers, but the pharaoh is characteristically arrogant about his own power, being the ruler of the land and basically a god on earth for Egypt. And she goads him into saying how she can teach him something about being a god on earth.
Well, really, when you're a pharaoh, even if you know you're not a god on earth, you really probably got to kind of play that up for everyone else, so they don't start questioning you.
Well,
because really, if anyone was a big enough of a D-bag to think they really were a god on earth like that, I'm not buying into it.
Well, you know, you tell yourself something long enough, I think you'll buy it.
Yeah. Of course, then again, I mean, there's some people these days. I wouldn't put it past them, I guess.
So in any case, she starts to basically goad the pharaoh into releasing her chains so that she can dance for him. And he kind of liked that idea because it showed his power, and he alluded that, okay, you can start with dancing, and then I'm going to move on from there. And just as she is...
He's going to take her to the champagne room.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the intention. But as she's unleashed, then she starts to be surrounded by mystical creatures. And the two women that are flanking the pharaoh... There's somebody who is basically a queen type figure and her servant. That's when they really start getting involved, and you see them whispering at each other, and it's clear that the queen of Egypt here has the witchblade. And her servant, they're both basically comparing notes, going, oh, there's some things going on that I don't think we want to deal with. But she'll not find it undefended, and we see that Pharaoh's queen turn into the full yielding witchblade, and the attendant is the Angelus. And they also are clearly a lot closer than sisters in this book.
Yes, yes, they are. And it's awesome. But not just, you know, oh, look, it's titillating. It's two girls. I like how it counters the relationship with that the current Witchblade has with the darkness.
It does. That's a really good point. So they are clearly lovers. They are clearly connected. And, yeah, in a very similar yet different way from how Jackie and Sarah are right now. So they engage this creature, this mystical woman, who also calls forth one of her servants, her son, Kingu, which is a large beast. And I actually have done a good amount of research on who this character is. But she reveals herself to be Tiamat, who is an old Babylonian great mother of the gods. And as you look through, it's really cool how Ron Mars peppered in some of this old Babylonian mythology. As he's apt to do, he'll source a lot of these mythical and religious themes and blend them into the story. So Tiamat was basically the goddess of all goddesses. She's the mother of all the gods of Babylon. And she brings forth Kingu, and that is a... it's a different spelling here. They've got it spelled K-I-N-G-U, but in mythology, Kingu was her champion. She rallied a horned serpent, a Mushusu dragon, a Lamu hero, a Yugalo demon, a rabid dog, a scorpion man, Umu demons, a fish man, a bull man, and 11 others, and formed Kingu out of him. And so that is what we see basically drawn on the page by Sayich here.
Huh.
So Kingu grabs the Angelus, the Witchblade takes a strike, and she pins Tiamat against the wall. And at the same time, in the bustle, the Angelus comes free and drives her spear right through the heart of Kingu, killing him, and basically driving Tiamat insane, but insane to the point where she lets her defenses down a little bit. The Witchblade comes up and shields the Angelus and the Witchblade as they create a crown with which to hold her, as they say, to usurp the usurper. And they get a hold of, in one bold move, the Angelus grabs Tiamat, and they slam this crown/mask over her head, and it basically vaporizes her and puts her essence into the crown. Then we have what my favorite panel of the whole book, my favorite page, where they show the crown being passed through the years, and we'll talk about that in more detail a little bit later in the show. And then it jumps to modern times, where we have an opulent penthouse apartment, and it is being looted by a cat burglar. And do you have any idea who that is taking the crown, Josh?
Selena Kyle?
It's kind of Kyle-like. I just didn't know if you'd seen her anywhere before. And
she doesn't look familiar, but I was kind of looking. I'm like, she looks kind of like Darwin Cook-influenced Selena Kyle, which
there's a lot to be said for that.
It may not be at all, but yeah, that's what it reminded me of, and I don't mind that at all.
So the cat burglar steals the crown from a glass case in this apartment and jumps away, leaving basically the line, nice place, but he should have invested in a better alarm system. That cuts over to a later scene where you see Sarah Pizzini on the scene, and Sarah's first words are, nice place, but he should have invested in a better alarm system. So they click already. They are investigating this break-in. It was the apartment happened to be one that was owned by Gerard Irons, so
bum bum bum.
So they called in Sarah because of her experience, yes, with the Irons family.
We haven't seen Gerard, I think, since what, around issue 110 something.
Yeah, and I was glad to see him come up because there was a little question in my memory as to whether I thought he was basically fought and they never got the body kind of thing. You know, it's like I didn't think he was dead, but I thought he was definitely out of commission. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. And then we thought for a while he might be the guy pulling the string, the survivor in Artifacts, which obviously we completely missed something because he's.
Yeah. I can eliminate
in upstate New York in a penitentiary.
And he is in upstate New York in a penitentiary.
I totally don't think I pronounced that correctly just now.
I thought you did.
Oh, all right then.
But Sarah she's volunteered to go up and interview Mr. Irons personally. And then that's something that we'll look forward to. And then it cuts over to a scene of the burglar, and she puts the helmet on her head, is obviously being...
Uh-oh.
Obviously taken influence by the crown. She transforms, and she says, Tiamat has returned. We also have a little bit in there with the investigator who's putting the heat on to Sarah, who has been a thread through this. But
I was going to say, the internal affairs guy, that actually, we could talk about some recently announced news.
Yes.
That will be very spoilerific. Not very spoilerific, but we'll figure out what happens by issue 151.
I would say that's, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there are definitely some spoilers in the news. The big news you've probably heard, if you listen to this show, you know this news. The new Witchblade writer that's going to start with 151 is Tim Seeley, who's the creator of Hack Slash and has also done several projects for the Big Two and for Image and for Devil's Due and for, you know, various else. But Tim is a terrific artist and a really growing as a writer, I think, and he's a really hot talent right now, and it's great to see him come on the book. And the other news, that's the spoilerific news, is...
Oh, yeah, Sarah's going to be moving to Chicago.
So that'll bring up a lot of things. I know the Image Addiction guys believe that Gleason's going to buy it, and so that'll be part of her location.
Oh, totally. I can't see that he wouldn't. I
don't know. I can kind of see that he wouldn't, but...
I don't think Tim would kill him, but I could very much see Ron killing him. But at the same time, I could understand if Ron just maybe got rid of him mysteriously so that someone else could use him later on. But I've been waiting for Gleason to buy it in Artifacts since the first interview Ron did with Comic Book Resources.
And that's I was first thinking that's probably where it will happen,
because we haven't seen that sacrifice yet.
No, but I still think that it'll be in the Witchblade title. When Gleason dies, just because of the nature of how this story's written, and they're just walking around as partners. So this is either, I don't know if this is pre or post Artifacts, but it's just one of those continuity questions. But I'm kind of thinking this is almost post Artifacts. So that was a great issue. I think 146 was really good. I believe that it's not a bad issue for new readers to jump on. There's a couple things that may be a little confusing that they'd pick up on, but this is a pretty good first issue of a story arc for new people. And somebody who's not a new person but has been reading Top Cow is Jason. And Jason, what did you think of Witchblade 146?
I really liked it a lot. I liked the beginning and the, you know, passage of time. That was pretty cool. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed the art and the writing, like I always do with Witchblade, and yeah, I'd give it to somebody to check out, definitely.
The only thing I thought was, like, somebody might not understand what the Angelus was and why that girl had wings, but everything else, it seemed like it would be pretty accessible to anybody.
That's what Wikipedia is for.
Yeah.
That's true.
After reading it, I actually went on Wikipedia and looked up Tiamat to see if it was an existing, like, character from something, from Top Cow or mythology or whatever. I just wanted to know more about Tiamat. So,
yeah, there's some pretty cool things. We talked a little bit about Tiamat. The other thing that's interesting is that one of Tiamat's main foes was somebody named Marduk, and that's who basically commanded the army that she fought, and Marduk eventually took her down. And Marduk happens to be the name of the field general of the Pharaoh in this book, so that's, you know, this is kind of an interesting connection and nod.
So Marduk's getting all the credit for the Witchblade and the Angelus' work.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. now we see history as it really should have been reported, because they've, you know, obviously, you know, women in roles of power get those, that information gets suppressed in through histories.
I almost said The Shaft, but
but we're keeping our family ratings.
So. Yes.
So one of my favorite pages, I alluded to it before, but it shows five panels of this crown of Tiamat being handed down through history. The first panel is 30 BC, and it's clear that somebody, and it's not the wielder of the Witchblade, because I first thought, well, maybe it's that Witchblade wielder that had the crown, created the crown, but somebody hands it over to who I'm thinking might be Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar. Because that is right around 30 BC, or 30 BC is the year that Cleopatra committed suicide. It's the year that Octavian took over Egypt for the Roman Empire, and so it's basically the helmet being handed from a woman in power, perhaps even Cleopatra herself, to Augustus Caesar. Then it jumps to 410 AD, and you see, you know, the. You see a hand and body burning in the corner while a Visigoth is taking it. And that is basically the sack of Rome took place in 410 AD when Alaric, the king of the Visigoths, pretty much took it down, and that was the end of Roman Britain as well. So I thought that was real cool. So it gets in the hands of more barbaric. In 783 AD, which is a little bit after the fall of the Visigoths, so obviously the crown keeps moving around, it's being handed out by a crusader to somebody with the church, and that's also paved the way for the Muslim rise in the world, although this, where it's being handed to, has a Christian cross on it, so it's obviously something with some of the early crusades.
I would say that panel, though, it's a bit ambiguous as to who's handing it to whom.
Oh, good. Yeah, you're right. I just assumed that it was being handed to the face we see in the panel, but there's also an unseen participant that's in there. That's a good point.
The flow of the page would tell me that it's being handed to, that the person whose face we see. But
yeah,
that's,
it seems that way. Then it goes to 1191 AD, and I believe it's somebody in Crusader chainmail, has a skull helmet. I believe, and I didn't go back and look at the Witchblade trade where this is, but I believe that that is Kenneth Irons. Because in 1191, that's the end of the Third Crusade, and that's the year also that they drank from the Holy Grail, he and his son and the third party. So that's where he achieved immortality, basically right after this point.
And that would mean that it's been in the Irons family probably since. Okay.
And that's how Gerard already had it. They've held it for many centuries because they got it in 1191 AD. And then it jumps into last night where they show it in Gerard Irons' apartment. So 146, Witchblade 146 is still on the shelves. Your retailer may have a copy. If not, there's a good chance they can get one. So we recommend that you go to the comic shop today. Run and get it if you don't already have it.
Right now, leave work.
Pause this. And you know what you can do? You can put your iPod in your car and listen to the rest of the show, because now we're going to talk about donuts. We're kind of...
Donuts.
Yeah, we've got a dozen donuts from Lane's Bakery in Madison on Park Street. This is a repeat performance for Lane's, because so far they're in our... They're kind of at the top for us.
Top one for apple fritters.
Yeah, definitely for apple fritters. So we've got a wide variety, and we've got a few apple fritters. And we are also lucky that we have a pastry chef here with us. Another special guest. She didn't introduce herself on the beginning of the show, but we're going to try to talk her into coming on and telling us a little bit about her critique of it, and maybe just a little bit more about where donut making falls in the career and life of a typical pastry chef, and then of her as a pastry chef.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Wallers.
And Alyssa, so you had an apple fritter. What do you think?
It was pretty delicious. It was good times. It was nice, tender. The only thing I wanted was a little bit more apple, but otherwise it was good.
Yeah, that's good. And I like them because they use... I could be wrong, but that's fresh apple they're using in there. That's not pie filling, is it?
No, it's definitely not pie filling.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. So now, how long have you been a pastry chef?
Probably around 10 years now.
Oh, wow, that's great. So now, are you? Do you work for a bakery, or are you independent, or you work for a hotel or catering company?
I work for a small bakery now, but I used to work, and I do a little bit of catering, but I also used to work in hotels quite a bit before the small bakery.
Hey, I need to talk to you before this is done.
Okay.
It's rare that we get we get some comic professionals on the show, but it's really great to get a donut professional on the show. And have you made donuts in your career?
I have made donuts in my career. I've eaten a lot of them. But yeah.
And what would you say is the key element to a successful donut making?
Eating them fresh is always the best. And it depends on the kind of donut, but like for the apple fritter, which is kind of like a yeast raised donut, just making sure that your dough, it's like a really good dough, and letting it, you know, raise and cooking it at the right temperature in the oil.
Like a yeast donut that gets raised before it's fried off, so you don't just like mix it up and drop it in the fryer.
No, it's more like a bread kind of.
How long would it rise?
It depends. Sometimes you do like a double rise. So you like will let it rise and then you push it down. Mm-hmm. And you put it in the fridge maybe and then you let it rise again.
You do that with a donut ring too?
They're usually cut. So you like roll it out and then you cut it to whatever shape you want.
And then it just rises once then in that case?
Once you cut it just rises once.
Okay. Fascinating.
It is.
I really do like donuts, so it's good. Well, thanks for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
And Jason right now is sampling. He's got a cake donut, and I'm like pulling the whole is there anything else I can get you, sir, thing that the waitress does. It waits right until you have a total mouthful. But what do you think, buddy? How is that?
Yeah, that's always crazy how that happens. It's like they plan it so you can't say anything bad.
Yeah, right.
Or ask for anything.
Exactly. It's too much work for me.
I just usually end up nodding and smiling. Yeah. That happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thumbs up. It's good.
See now, and I put the index finger up and make them stand there while I finish my.
Should try that next time. But it's really good donut. Nice and soft. It's got some chocolate icing on it. Tasty. And it's my first time having Elaine's donut, so yeah, I'll be back.
Nice. Any donut wisdom, Josh?
I had a bunch of Rocky Rococos earlier, so I'm actually too full to eat any donuts right now.
Well, we're going to do an episode of pizza in Top Cow, but we're going to have Jason make the pizza for us, so that's going to be a different...
I'm sorry.
That'll be a different episode.
Yeah, that's up to you guys if you really want to do that. I mean, I'm down for it, but, you know, your guys' choice.
I mean, I'll eat it, don't get me wrong. I just don't want to make you have to make it.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's all.
Josh is a lot nicer guy than I am.
Yeah, no, it's no problem. I get that a lot. Like, why don't you just bring pizza? It's like, why didn't you tell me that before I left work?
Yeah.
I totally could have done that.
I'm trying to think, is there... Oh, you know what we haven't talked about yet?
What's that?
That we forget half the time. People can follow us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
Follow us on Twitter. I should know those really well. Woo, 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 you know it.
We are at DTC Podcast on Twitter. And our Facebook page, you can put in Donuts and Top Cow. And if you have trouble finding us, we do spell donuts with the D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T-S because we're just that into our culinary hobbies that we want to make sure we nail it just right. No abbreviations around here.
And because I wanted it to look all fancy schmancy.
Right. And then also, please... send us email. We're interested in your thoughts. We're interested in your suggestions. We're interested in your feedback, even if it's negative, whatever. Actually, I like negative feedback because it helps us get better. And we can be reached at dtcpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can review us on iTunes.
The iTunes reviews rock. We're very grateful for the 5 that we have now. We're up to 5, and I'm shocked. It's really great.
One more, and one hand isn't going to cut it.
So, thank you for listening. Have a great week.
Good journey.